Just, I think it's very practical advice on the pride and low self-esteem part that we discussed.
Yeah.
So when we identify, for example, that we're having that type of...
having what?
That our mind is reacting in that way.
Which way? Low self-esteem?
Lack of humility or something like that.
No, be more precise.
Okay.
Low self-esteem. I'm bad. I'm no good.
No, worse
what?
Than that. How dare that person be like that and not me?
Well, that's really what pride is saying.
Right.
And that's what low self-esteem is. It's just a way of, it's my way of saying what these thoughts, all these thoughts are stories that we're telling that are very instinctive. So we have to spell the story out. I think that's a way of saying what low self-esteem is. It's like self-loathing. I'm horrible. I'm hopeless. All these people are so much better than me. But what I'm saying is underneath that, it feels like it's saying, I should be the person who's high because we feel insecure, you know. That's what I'm saying. So then, question?
I agree with that. But what I mean is, so just when that happens, what can we do to counterbalance it?
Starling, that question is the entire question about what Buddhist practice is. So 99% of the time, we don't catch it when it first arises because it's so ancient, it's so deep. We wait till it becomes as a deep emotion, and that's like the wheels falling off. It's a bit late to say what to do. That's why we have to start by getting some focus. That's why we have to practice stepping out of our head. That's how we have to use that skill in our daily life, not just to notice the outside, but constantly pay attention to in here and not just to wait till the feeling comes, which is when the body is involved. That is too late. It's already Vesuvius exploding. So that with practice, we have to start to catch that thought. I mean, that's still subtle, but begin to hear, to feel it and then hear it. And then what do you think you do with it? What would be the obvious thing you do with it? What's the obvious thing you do with a misconception?
Well, turn it around.
Well, be more simple. What do you mean turn it around? Well, if you're playing the wrong note on the piano, what's your solution?
And
you play the right note. You change it. So you argue with it. It's a conceptual story. It's not just one little baby thought, oh, I'm horrible, and that's it. It's an entire novel we've written. So you have to argue with it. And what do you use to argue with it? The truth.
So you read.
What?
So you read.
Well, we're learning Buddha's view here. It's Buddha's music we're learning, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
We can use Jung if you like. You can use who you like. We don't make it up. We're using Buddha's view of the world, this sophisticated view of the mind. So when you can hear the misconception, then obviously the opposite is the truth. So there's a lot of stuff in there. It's very sophisticated. It's all based on ego grasping, which believes it's self-existent. And then you can hear, you say you hear the distortion. So to speak simply, what would be an argument in your mind with the thought of I'm a creep? What would be the argument? Think of it. Tell me. Just make it up. What do you think? What's the argument?
Well, first of all, I doesn't intrinsically exist.
What, dear?
So, first of all, I doesn't intrinsically
No, that's an argument with ego grasping.
Mm-hmm.
That's not an argument with low self-esteem.
Okay,
you've got to be direct.
What's
the exact opposite? Just talk about it. Be very simple.
Well,
that's a good start. Well, mainly to say, no, honey, you're exaggerating. That's it. That's the main one. Ego, you know, I'm a creep. Well, no, you're not. It's like what the Catholics have a great saying. Don't criticize the sinner. Criticize the sin. So if there is some fault in you, if there is some fault in you, then you recognize it's true. Well, it is right. I can't play piano very well, but it doesn't mean I'm a bad person. It's exaggerating it. So you be more accurate. You see the problem. You did maybe shout at somebody. Maybe you did do something, so you own it, and then you argue with the other rubbish, kind of calm your poor mind down. This is what Buddhist practice is, and the more sophisticated we can be in knowing exactly that concept and what it thinks, the more you can be accurate in your application of the antidote, of the argument with it. It's not that easy, but it takes time and learning. Sometimes just tell yourself to shut up. Give it a break with me and back off and be quiet. That's enough when it's fairly small. But if it's a full-blown emotion, you've got to calm yourself down and argue in lots of ways. Do you understand? Okay. Buddha has identified 84,000. Let's start with 3 or 4. It's good enough. Do you understand? What else, people? Yeah. Si.
Circa. Grazie. Circa l'attaccamento al dolore. Ci spiega per cortesia. Grazie.
If you can explain the attachment to the pain.
To our suffering. I think you need to say a bit more what you mean by that. Give the microphone. Just spell it out for all of our sake.
Ci sono delle persone, per esempio anche in ospedale, che vorrebbero essere, diciamo così, guarite, ma in un certo senso non hanno difficoltà a guarire all'interno, cioè nel senso delle emozioni. Questo un po'.
There are people who are in hospital that they would like to be healed, they would like to be cured, but they have difficulties in healing their inner emotions, their internally.
But I mean, don't we all? I'm just thinking now, and as an example, this person just wrote to me, and we all recognize this. She's in the midst of this incredible rage. As she said, the anger is uncontrolled. All I can think of is this rage against this husband who's hurt her. So you could say we are attached to that pain. But it's more simple. It's just a deep, deep habit. You know, if the water's been running a long time in the earth, it digs a channel, and the water just runs in that channel. Well, we've dug very deep channels in our minds, and when the emotion comes after a lot of practice, it's almost impossible to stop it. You know, you can eventually, but you just don't say, "Oh, I must stop being angry." So you can say we are addicted to that anger, but it's more like just this habit, and it's unbearable, and we can't see the way out, and then we can't stop thinking about it. Well, you could argue that inability to stop thinking about it, that's the function of attachment. Attachment thinks about the thing all the time. So attachment is there. And it's just because it's deep, deep habit. That's the main one, really. They say that we're propelled by the force of our past karma. And then so it's just the strength of our other virtues that then we have to apply to dig new grooves in the mind so we can have the courage to know that we can give it up. But it's incredibly painful, and sometimes people never can, and they die with this rage 50 years later, you know. Is that what you're talking about? This just shows how hard practice is. And that's why I think in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, this job, as I said before, the analogy of playing football, you can't just get the ball in the net by working on it. You can't just start changing the mind. Our mind is too deeply deluded. The habits are too strong. That's why we have to do the purification practices. So if you know, he says how to get the ball in the net, he says go off and do jogging for 5 miles or 5 kilometres. I can't see a relationship between jogging and getting the ball in the net. Well, we can't see the relationship between doing prostrations and changing your mind. But it weakens the delusions, and it puts atomic bombs underneath and enables us to then do the work of working on our mind. That's why even though some of us have been Buddhists for 40 years, still get angry, still blame other people, still feel resentful, still don't get karma. It really is difficult. It's just difficult. Isn't it? Isn't it? I mean, isn't it? So we've got to be very humble. Very humble and patient with ourselves. And that's where, let's say, you know, I remember a friend of mine, just talking to a friend one time recently about a person she knows, who's a nun. Not you don't know her, this person. It's another nun in another universe. Don't worry about it. Don't try to think, who am I talking about? There's no one you know. Another country, another tradition. Who's been a nun for years and years and years, but doesn't seem like she's changed her mind much. Still angry, still resentful, still blaming people, still feeling guilty, not taking responsibility. But at the same time, she works and lives with her lama and serves her lama. So on the one side, you can see no progress in her mind, possibly. But that might be true. But the other thing that is hopeful with this is why we have to understand the benefit of doing practices that are very powerful for purification and very powerful for creating merit, that sow very powerful seeds in our mind that won't bring results until next life. We've got to accept that that's fantastic. At least you rejoice that she's not changing her mind. Right, you don't rejoice in that, but you rejoice that she's sowing incredibly powerful seeds by serving her guru and serving the Dharma, and this will bring unbelievably blissful results in the future. So at least that much is happening. You see, part of the thing is too, we often think that if if we don't see the result now, we're not practicing. This is just not true. So there's two different things I'm saying here, you know. In fact, you might even get more angry, more upset, like that monk we know who had this rage he could not believe after years of retreat. And Rinpoche just laughed and laughed and said, fantastic, the dirt has to come out. So it could almost, the sign of being more angry and more resentful can almost be a sign of purification. So it's really hard to be so simple about it, you know. So interesting. Yeah. Are we communicating? We have to remember these things, you know. Yeah. What else, people? Something else? Questions? We'll just go on talking more about the mind then. Let's look at, I find this really interesting to see how we, because of this way, this technology that I'm about to describe roughly, how we're locked into samsara and why it is so hard to change. So I like to use the example of that little fisherman, or anybody for that matter, who's got a negative habit. So there's this boy who's been in the lower realms in the past, we can deduce that, but completed the karma of killing, and somehow like a miracle, but not a miracle really, virtue ripened and he got a human rebirth again. Amazing. Because he hadn't purified, did extra work by purifying and living in vows, he didn't purify the residual results of karma. The complete result of the killing finished that track and he got a human birth, but there were the residual results left over, and in particular the worst one, the habit to keep killing. So the way it works, I think, is something like this. He gets born, programmed with all these tendencies. He's a little boy. He doesn't think of fishing until he meets fishing. You don't think of killing fish until you meet fishing. The condition has to ripen, you know? Well, in this case, it did. He's like 5. I don't know how old he was. And he met fishing for the first time. Well, what happens is like this. Something like this. That condition triggers. It's like triggering the memory, basically. Triggering the karmic seed. Triggering the karma. The imprint from the habit of killing. He sees the scenario, it triggers that habit. That means it's like he remembers it, but we don't think of it like that. You know, when you meet people, you just adore them. You meet this person, it's like they're the ancient friend, like you've known each other forever. You know, this 19-year-old white supremacist read Hitler. That book triggered his imprints in his mind that were already there but were latent. So he had to read those words for it to trigger his own tendencies. It's like that. So this triggered, so this then because of the familiarity, what happens, and this is the tragedy, instantaneously unbelievable pleasure, pleasant feelings were triggered. And then the next millisecond, attachment kicks in and paints an amazingly divine picture of this scenario called fishing. So it appears to his mind as marvelous, and also because it triggers pleasure, the logic is, well, this must be fantastic. It triggers such pleasure. Of course I'll do it again. That's how we're stuck in samsara. So the pleasure is triggered from the habit. This is a tragedy. And the stronger the habit, the more the pleasure. This is the tragedy. One man I read about, some Australian journalist, he wrote about his first he was into fishing. He said his first experience when he first went trout fishing, it was like a cosmic experience. All that means is that much pleasure indicated that much familiarity with killing. You know, I mean, there's, for example, in America years ago, I remember reading about some fellow who tortured people. He called himself BTK, Bind, Torture, Kill. He kidnapped people. He had this whole dungeon, secret. He couldn't do it in public. The world doesn't approve. He kidnapped people. more than one person, usually couples or families, and he'd put them in this dungeon, he'd bind them, then he'd torture them. And he would get, as he called it, he was in Kansas, and they don't have death row there, so he confessed to every one of these 35 murders in detail. They caught him eventually. He was this nice Christian gentleman. He lived a good life, but he had this secret life, you know. Why? Habit. It's all, everything's habit, you know. Just karma. He knows the world doesn't approve. Of course, he has to do it secretly. Fishing is fine. People approve of it. So he would get his pleasure. This is the thing, is we can't get this. When you're familiar with an action, you've been doing it that often, it triggers pleasure. So the more the pleasure, the indicator of the strength of the action, the habit. So when we talk about sexual pleasure, we get very confused because we think it was some special, unique, kind of mystical kind of, especially because if it's Christian, and it's a special gift that God gave you, and you're only allowed to have it with a blessing from God, which is called marriage, right? I'm not being rude now. That's how they think about it. Because the pleasure is so delicious, they have to think it comes from God. It's just called pleasure. So it indicates, doesn't it, the habit that's most deep is having sex, sexual contact. Because that brings the most intense pleasure. And physically even they understand it. In Tantra they describe it. Well, this torturer, he said, he called it sexual pleasure. All he meant was the habit must have been so deep from past life of torturing, probably as an animal. That's what animals do with respect to animals. They torture because their ignorance is so profound. So he got that much pleasure from it. He didn't know why. His mother didn't teach him. So this is the trouble with pleasant feelings. We desperately want pleasant feelings. So if you've got the karma to get pleasant feelings from killing and torturing and jumping on little girls all day, I mean, please have compassion for them. We just have pleasure from eating pathetic old cake. Best we can do. Habit. The stronger the pleasure, the more the habit. This is the tragedy of samsara. And the biggest tragedy is it brings the pleasure. And then instantly attachment kicks in and paints this picture that makes it divine. So this fisherman, this kind man, you know, you can imagine, going fishing every day, thinking of it all the time, completely found the meaning of life, in love with it, which means he thinks about it all the time. His whole life was based on killing fish. He sat in that boat catching his fish, the fisher in the boat. He sees these little fish flapping. This is the tragedy of attachment. He didn't see suffering. The torturer saw the suffering and he got pleasure from it. Blissful pleasure. Of course he couldn't stop. We all want pleasure. He knew intellectually it wasn't cool. That's why he did it in secret. But the habit, depth of the habit. We've got to understand the depth of habit when Buddha talks about karma, you know. We just say our habit is to eat too much cake. Excuse me. Look how hard that is to change. The little tiny bit of pleasure that comes from pathetic old cake. Look how desperately we try. Maybe the next piece will do it. All it does is make us fat. We know that. And give us indigestion. But we're desperate. We don't know where to turn, you know. That's attachment. The habit's there, meet the condition, triggers it, triggers pleasure, right there, contact with the object, right there, like in the 12 links. Then attachment kicks in. That's the killer. It then paints an amazing picture. That journalist said it was like trout fishing was like a cosmic experience. What he meant was he had incredible pleasure. So what appeared to him, because of attachment then comes in and makes a picture, it made it look like being in love, like being divine. That's how the torturer felt. He got blissful experiences. We don't get that in our culture. There's no explanation for it. This is a technical explanation. Feeling. Every second there's either a pleasant or an unpleasant feeling. And all we want is pleasant feelings. We will do anything to get it. And that's because we can't get many of them. We are desperate. And that's why we kill ourselves. Because we can't bear the unpleasant feelings. We're bereft. We're frantic. We can't bear the unpleasant feelings. We go mad. This is samsara. Okay, there's good things too. We haven't talked about the good things. We've got to look at the problems first. Our virtues are our saving grace. That's how we win this room. Not in the... watching sex videos. I mean, it's okay. Watch your videos. It's okay. Not complaining, not criticizing. So at least Islam Zoba says, try not to believe in our karmic appearances. Say to ourselves, there's pleasure coming from this, I can see it. But don't believe the story. Attachment's lying to us. The pleasure's real. But look what triggers it. Habit to do negative things. That's why it's on the bodhisattva path. In the first stage of the practice, there's no wriggle room. You just try to control your attachment. You try to control your eating, control your sex, control the rest. To calm the senses down, to discipline the body and speech. On the bodhisattva's path, it's more marvelous, more amazing, more skillful, more brilliant. Not easier, because it's dependent upon good discipline. There, Rinpoche says, you can use attachment. Don't even wait till you get to Tantra. You can use attachment. Be wise. So at least you're going to be attached. You don't want to give up sex, drugs and rock and roll, you know? And you don't want to go and meditate all day and night, which 99% of us don't want to do. We haven't got the karma. We've got to have ordinary life with sex, drugs and rock and roll and husbands and wives and whatever you have. Then at least be attached to a person who's good for you, who's virtuous. If you're a great bodhisattva, yeah, marry a creep. That's good. Well done. But most of us aren't that brave, you know? You understand? We're not that brave. So marry a nice person who's kind and loving, especially if they're rich and they'll support your dharma. That's the best partner to have. I mean, I'm being practical here. If I'm going to have one, that'd be the one I'd have. Rich. So they can support you. Wow, that's the best partner possible. Some people are lucky enough to have that. And it'd be nice if they're nice as well. Then you're kind of skillful, you know. And Rinpoche talks about that at death. It's very interesting. The main source of suffering at death is fear. And the main reason we have fear is because of attachment. Attachment to what? This. And because at the time of death, it's very technical, before you even stop breathing, is the way that Rinpoche describes the 12 links of dependent arising. They have a particular function at death. And before you stop breathing, about the second or the third of those 8 stages, intense craving and grasping kick in automatically. And they're just intense levels of attachment. And it's unbelievable grasping at this. It's going to happen no matter what. That's why we need to help a person at the time of death. And they need us most right then, when they're dying, to help them navigate that. Make them feel secure and virtuous. And when the mind is virtuous, the mind's peaceful. When the mind's peaceful, it's virtuous. And that'll help when the grasping does come. It triggers the number 2 link, which is the karmic seed that will then program you for the next life. That happens even before you stop breathing. So Rinpoche says you use attachment. He says the main cause. He says one of the main causes, one of the causes for us to get a human body, not only was the morality of non-killing, not only was the generosity of practicing in the past that gave us a decent human rebirth, but we must have had strong grasping at the time of our death for a human birth. So your mummy's dying, and she's a Catholic, and she's got fear, and everybody has. And one of the functions of attachment is to hold on. Well, another function of attachment is to look forward to something. Well, you use that aspect. You tell her how God loves her. God is in heaven. God is waiting for God. Heaven is beautiful, Mummy. I've been reading about heaven. It sounds so divine. I can't wait to go there. Mummy, think of heaven. So she'll start thinking of heaven and look forward to heaven, which is attachment, instead of a stupid, old, ugly body. And she'll die with a relaxed mind. It's skillful means, you know. If you use attachment. That's the bodhisattva approach. There's no talk like doing that in the Hinayana. Very wise. If you're going to be attached, if you're going to have a job and you've got to work and you've got attachment and you're highly advanced, then be attached to a good job that benefits others. How amazing. I mean, I'm attached to my job. I love doing my job. You can tell I'm so excited. I ain't a bodhisattva, I promise. It's just attachment. But luckily, it's attached to something decent, isn't it? Something worthwhile. Do you understand? I'm attached to, but I can see, but, okay. You understand? To be wise, you know. See our minds, be skillful. Of course, we've got to give it up in the end. Must. Will, if we keep practicing. Be skillful, you know. So, dissatisfaction is there. What's missing? Oh, cake. Cake, we'll hear it, get all excited. Craving kicks in, get the cake. Anticipating, that's attachment. Craving, that's attachment. Imagining it, that's attachment. Exaggerating is deliciousness, that's attachment. Getting it, putting in the mouth, waiting for the pleasure. All of it's to get that pleasure. You don't get the cake and look at it and touch it and then put it in the cupboard again. That would be stupid. You get it to put it in this hole. Not this hole, this one. We know which hole it goes. The whole that work, all that exercise, all that buying, the food, the cooking, the hours and hours, so you can put it in your mouth and have a moment of pleasure. Okay, the cooking of it probably is pleasure as well, at least that, if it does give you pleasure. If not, you're very depressing. I read about, in New York Times, I read about this cook in America. It was very brilliant, with a brilliant mind, very brilliant, kind of unusual cook, woman. She said, I want to cook till the end of time. Clearly attachment, what else? Attachment is also, when you mix it with intelligence, that's how come we have this universe we've got. Attachment mixed with just very deep attachment, craving, you just harm people. You just want to have sex all day, like this kind of monkey, some kind of monkey I read about, some kind of chimp or something. It climbs out, it comes out of his mummy's womb, he turns around and he has sex with her. No wasting time. And then when his grandma and his grandpa and his daddy and his sister and his auntie and his uncle, they're really attached to sex. They have it so strong, already born, no wasting time. So there's that kind of attachment. And then there's a more sophisticated attachment with us clever, intellectual, you know, bourgeois, educated people. That's intelligence. But we mix it with attachment. And attachment's a very brilliant, clever kind of mind. Attachment is what makes us create all these fancy things. Attachment embellishes, you see. Attachment embellishes something and makes it, and then you mix that with intelligence and maybe some virtue as well. I always think of Bach, you know. He was this ingenious, brilliant creator of sound. He took simple sound and he embellished it to the most incredible degree of sophistication, didn't he? That's attachment mixed with intelligence and, in his case, probably mixed with virtue. We can see this. So at least we're going to have it, use it to create marvellous things for the benefit of sentient beings. That's the bodhisattva path. Attachment's creativity, basically. Think about it. Artists embellish, you know, sound, like a musician. Picasso embellished and shapes and colour. That's it. It has to be with intelligence. So intelligence mixed with attachment is creativity. Our brilliant world, you know. Making brilliant things, making brilliant sounds, creating brilliant things. That's attachment mixed with intelligence. Hopefully mixed with virtue. Without virtue, it's a disaster. It's using it. That's the bodhisattva path. But if you don't know what attachment is, how can you use it? To learn about what it is first in high school. The nuts and bolts. Study low rig and then think about it. Analyze it. Understand it. Look at your mind. Work on it day by day. Putting meat on the bones. Then you know how to utilize it wisely. Don't leave it at the intellectual level. Not enough. So let's get excited about bliss, rapture, ecstasy. Lama learned these words. Don't know where he got them from. Don't ask me. But he learned these words. He was amazing, I tell you. Blows my mind. This is from Mahamudra. He wanted to get us excited, get us inspired. And when I first heard Lama Zopa, I just got depressed, you know. Oh, no. And then Lama Yeshe would come along and I'd feel, thank God, what a relief. This makes sense. Every time, you know, it was amazing. So this book, like I said, it's a commentary. Lama Yeshe gave this in 1982 in Australia. When was it? 1981, I forget, somewhere like that. August 81, it must have been. Yes, there it is. In August 1981 in Australia, was the first time he gave a highest yoga tantra initiation, the first time there had been one in Australia. Well, it was public anyway. It was Haruka. And he then taught this, you know, in the classic way. Always when you teach Mahamudra, they teach it in the framework of giving a highest yoga tantra, even though they give the sutra teaching. And then Lama gave a very short commentary on the tantric bit at the end, like a page, you know, in a fire. So basically it's just taking the two modes of meditation, the classic two modes of meditation, concentration and insight. Concentration and insight. Concentration comes from the Hindus. And if you teach it, if you actually put it in the Buddhist path, where it belongs in its character, it's a Theravadan teaching. Because a Theravadan practitioner needs it to realize emptiness. I mean, to get concentration to realize emptiness, which is also a Theravadan teaching. They're both Theravadan teachings. Because you need concentration and insight into emptiness to become to achieve your own nirvana. But they're taught in the Bodhisattva path in the framework of the Bodhisattva teachings at the end part, the very end of the six perfections. But in their character, they're Theravadan teachings, Hinayana teachings, high school teachings. And there's two modes of meditation. The first one, which is what most people think of as meditation, what the Hindus thought of as meditation, was the method for getting liberation. Pretty ingenious. There's a single point of concentration. Eventually they called it samadhi, you know. And these great Hindus went to the subtlest level of their mind where they considered that was liberation. Buddha says, no, you haven't gone far enough. There's still the imprint, there's still the delusion, there's still the grasping and an inherent me. They'd get rid of so much delusion, but not that one. And that's when he diverged in his own direction, in particular in relation to his own findings about the nature of self. That's where his emptiness teachings branch off. There are many teachings among the Hindus, you know, that are very similar. They talk about the non-dual teachings, for example. There's so many amazing, these brilliant, brilliant, brilliant Indians, incredible, incredible thinkers, incredible genius thinkers and philosophers and yogis and scholars. Unbelievable. Buddha came out of all of that. And then, as we know, in Buddhism, there's many that have cultivated over the centuries in India and then indeed in Tibet now. They haven't got texts on those. They haven't got done drupta for Tibetans yet, have they? Still Drupta's the tenets from the India. But among Tibetans now over the centuries are so many variations of interpretations of emptiness that have cultivated naturally because humans are different. So the Sakyas have got variations and the Kagyupas have got many variations. The Gelugpas have many variations. They've all got variations. But I don't think there's a Drupta text among the Tibetans yet. There should be. It's about 1,200 years late. Isn't it? Do you understand what I'm saying? What? Is there a text? Are there some teachings on the different views among the Tibetans published? Not that you know about.
Nothing.
What?
I don't know.
Do you see my point? Yeah. There's so many views about emptiness now among Tibetans. So many. She studies. You've studied some of the Hindu stuff, haven't you?
Yeah.
Right. You seeing the differences now when you're studying the Buddhist ones?
Yeah.
There you go.
But there are also differences.
Can't hear you.
Well,
of course there are. I'm saying that. Of course there are. So many as there are humans, there are variations of interpretations. And that's what's marvelous about studying Drupta, that text, is at least labelling some of the differences, you know. At least we can get our head around. So when we start talking about emptiness, we'll just touch on a little bit, some tiny, just some little baby differences in terms of understanding emptiness, you know. Yeah. So anyway, there's concentration. And you've got to have that before you get too far. But we mostly won't get it. It still doesn't mean we can't do lots of work. But because the mind is so berserk and so driven by the past karma and so much delusion, so much conceptuality and so much uncontrol, it is just not possible, literally not possible, to do the fine, subtle analysis that is demanded of us, excuse me, Buddha says, to argue with the subtlest, most primordial misconception. You've got to get to the microscope of your mind in single-pointed concentration. It's only that level of mind that's capable of doing the unpacking and unravelling and the seeing, insight into the seeing of the truth of emptiness. What's the Italian use of the word for insight? What do you say? So it's the same, insight. Because some languages have a weird word. It makes it sound like religion. But you use it in daily life, though? Do you use it in daily life? Or is it a bit religious sounding? We say in English, you know, oh, you get some insight into a problem. We say it in an ordinary language. Do you say that in Italian?
Yes.
You do?
Yes.
So it's a very down to...
In English.
What?
We use it in English.
What do you mean? You say insight?
Yes.
Oh, in Italian?
Yes.
Oh, there you go. Well, it's a good word. There you go. That's very interesting. It's very powerful meaning. And this is where the trouble is when we say the word affliction, for example. Because it's an abstract word we don't use, we make it sound like it's weird. Whereas if we see the meaning of it, it makes it ordinary word we use. So insight's a great word. We use that ordinary in English. Oh, yeah, I had a bit of insight into that problem last week. It's a really practical word. Well, that's vipassana. That's what it means. And the first one is concentration. Shamatha, calm abiding. So calm abiding and special insight. Calm abiding, special insight. These are the names for the results of these two techniques. Well, the first one, like I said, was invented by the Hindus, the ingenious Indians, you know, these brilliant scholars, brilliant yogis. So Buddha happily took that technique, and it's the central technique, and there are people like you and me right now accomplishing this, you know. So for the Hindus, I suppose, isn't it true? The result came from that, didn't it? There was no further, was there? That's right. And so whereas Buddha says, no, you've got to use this brilliant... Okay, the benefits... this is the thing, and now I'm going to read you. The benefits of single point of concentration are unbelievable. This is what Lama's trying to show to us. This is where we begin to taste the true nature of our mind, this bliss, this natural bliss, you know, which should be encouraging, not like make us greedy. If we don't understand what we're doing, and this is what is many stories you hear, like nightmare stories of people who must have some past karma from meditating, who start to meditate now and get incredible bliss. And because they have no idea about attachment, they have no idea about the mind, as Lama Yeshe says, they end up in a psychiatric hospital. They go crazy because you've got to know what you're doing. So you've got to have concentration, which has the bonus and the byproduct of being blissful, incidentally. But its purpose, its sole purpose for the Buddha is because you've accessed this subtle level of your mind, like the microscope of your mind, that level of subtlety and clarity and brilliance is what's capable of then going to the second mode of meditation and getting insight into how things exist. So in the Mahayana, in the Six Perfections, the sixth perfection is called special insight, as Lama says, you know. Now, before we even go there, special insight. But the fact is, you know, the fact is, we don't have to just use this for getting insight into emptiness. You use your concentration to get insight into everything in the path. You meditate on impermanence. You've got to get insight into impermanence, insight into karma, insight into the crazy mind. So you use this skill of concentration, and then you do this, into the second mode, you use this capacity for brilliant analysis, crystal clear analysis. That triggers the insight. So the goal in the second mode of meditation is to get insight into the reality, whatever it might be. The method you use in insight is this laser-like focused mind, but you don't just space out, you use it to do analysis. And because it's so focused, it's so capable, it can do brilliant analysis at a very subtle level. And that brilliant analysis with a focused mind is what then triggers the insight. Now, this is how they talk in Buddhism. But we actually know this process, and this is how we learn everything. But we don't use these words. Let me explain. When you go to listen to mathematics for the first time, and your teacher tells you that 1 + 1 = 2, you've never heard this before. This is a weird concept. You don't know, so you write it down. And she says, if she's a Buddhist, she'd say, go home, Ravina. Go to your room. Get a bit of concentration, please. And then you go to the second mode of meditation, and I want you to get insight into this and get the answer. I want you to get insight into the answer. That's what she'd say if she was a Buddhist. But what she says is, go and do your homework. So what do you think I'm going to do? Well, I'll go home. I'll go to my little desk. I'll close the door, and I'll try and get some concentration. I mean, if you're really scattered, you can do nothing, isn't it? So you've got to have some concentration, some focus. Hopefully close the door, tell your sisters to go away, and you've got a bit of focus. You get your organized self-focus first. Now when you've got a bit of focus, you'll now begin the real work. The real work is you have to start to learn to get insight into this little problem called 1 + 1 = 2. We don't say it like that, but that's what you're going to do. So it's so simple. What's the method you use to get insight into this? What's the method? Tell me, people, what's the method? What method do you use to get insight into 1 + 1 = 2? What's the method?
Reasoning.
Can't hear you.
Reasoning.
Think of it even more simple. You use thought. This is why, as we know, the Tibetans, the Gelugpas, call it analytical meditation, don't they? Well, let's analyse that phrase because we get so confused, you know. We think meditation is the first one where you don't do analysis. Then we think of analytical meditation. It sounds like we're squeezing our brain. We go crazy. But let's look at the word, the Tibetan word for meditation. It's the verb to familiarise, to become familiar with something. With what? Your mind. It's like called learning. When you're learning something, you're familiarising your mind with it, aren't you? It's really simple. So what you're going to do, that's the meaning of the word meditate. It's a very surprise to us because we think it's all about spacing out. It means to meditate. To meditate, gom, is to familiarise your mind. Well, with what? Two things, virtue and reality. Wait, not really. Let me finish. So the method, the point is the method to get insight is to think about it. This is very embarrassingly simple. Analytical meditation is a fancy term for thinking about something. But we don't know how to think coherently when it comes to emptiness because we haven't studied it enough. We don't know how to even think coherently about our problems because we just go around in circles and go crazy. So when you've learned about the mind, you know what these things are, you've got some basis for then doing some proper intelligent thinking on your cushion, if you want, with a bit of concentration to help you sort through the problem. Insight comes from intelligent thinking. You can't learn math if you don't have intelligent thinking. And you don't just think about it. You don't just go 1 + 1 = 2, 1 + 1 = 2, 1 + 1 = 2, hoping for something to happen. You get your little numbers, you go 1+, then you maybe you get your something to count your blocks, or you write it, and at some point you go, oh, I get it. That's an insight. That's how we learn everything. This is how we realize emptiness. This is how we learn about emptiness, impermanence, karma, and every other thing we're talking about here. This is the classic formal way to get insights very quickly, based on single point of concentration or any level of concentration you've got. Because we know you can't get much insight into your math, into your music, into anything if you can't have some focus. You're lost. You can't do anything. You can't even make a cake without focus. So concentration is this obvious first step. The real work is in the second mode where you now use that clear, sharp, focused mind to do very clear, sharp, logical thinking called analysis. That's how you get enlightened. That's what they mean by insight. That's what I mean by realizations, all these fancy words, you know. It's just using your mind in a brilliant, clear, focused, intelligent way. That's the classic mode, the classic way to realize emptiness, to realize anything. But Mahamudra uses the same two modes, but it's a different approach. Oh, yeah, the book. Okay, I'll tell you. I'll read you, get you excited first and tell you some of the qualities you'll have, some of the joys you'll have when you have a single point of concentration. Okay, chapter 5, the benefits of samadhi are incredible. You got the English one or the Italian? Oh, okay. That's page 39, I think. Or what page is it? Oh, yeah, okay. Okay. All right. So, as we know, this first one, concentration, invented by the genius Indians, calm abiding, shamatha. That's the name of the end result. To achieve the realization of Mahamudra, the reality of non-duality, we first need to develop calm abiding. In fact, it's not possible without it. And you've got to remember why. It's because these mental afflictions, these mental illnesses, these disturbing emotions are so primordially, instinctively deep. And when we hear that they're concepts, it sounds like a cruel joke to us when we think of the pain of anger and the pain of depression and the physical pain of anxiety and the berserkness of our thoughts. It seems like a joke to call them conceptual. But that's what they're rooted in. All the emotional component, the physicality that we experience, is the tip of the tip of the tip of the tip of the iceberg of all these afflictions. So we've got to have this incredible subtle focus in order to unpack and unravel all these misconceptions in a brilliant, clear way. especially ego grasping, the root delusion. But it happens to be that itself has got amazing benefits. No question about that. So we must achieve the subtler levels of consciousness of indestructible one-pointed concentration, what in Sanskrit we call samadhi. It's difficult to realize non-duality. Lama uses many terms, always uses many terms to try and get us to understand what he's talking about. So he uses lots of synonyms for emptiness, really. Non-duality, you know, you'll hear. Mahamudra is a term referring to emptiness. It is difficult to realize non-duality, not because it's hiding from us, but because our concepts are so thick. In other words, right now, this is what they mean by great seal. Everything is sealed. It is the nature of everything in the universe that it is in its nature. It is naturally lacking intrinsic existence. Of course, this is subtle to us. We never thought in the first place that things had intrinsic existence. We'll talk about this after lunch. But it's utterly the way everything is. It's staring at us right now. Emptiness, he's saying, emptiness is not hiding from us. It is staring at, in the face, it is staring at us. The lacking of intrinsic character is in the microphone, in that, in everything that exists. Everything that does exist has that character naturally. But because we're as blind as bats, because of this ego grasping, we literally cannot see it. So it's difficult to realize it, not because it's hiding from us, but because our concepts are so thick, our misconceptions, layers and layers and layers. So we must refine our concepts. We must achieve subtle mindfulness, subtle awareness, and subtle clarity. Otherwise, there is no way we can see the unconscious levels of ego grasping an independent self. Not possible. Samadhi is the source of liberation. Without perfect samadhi, then, there is no way to become liberated from samsara and no way to achieve enlightenment. There is no exception, whether we're Christian, Muslim, Hindu, or Buddhist. To cut the dualistic view, we need calm abiding. But calm abiding is not enough. On the other hand, some people actually think that this state of samadhi, this one-pointed concentration, is all we need in order to cut ego. But that is wrong. Lama Tsongkhapa reminds us that calm abiding alone is not enough to cut the dualistic view. We also need to develop special insight, or vipassana in Sanskrit. In Tibetan, we call it tlak tong. Tlak meaning extra. Tong meaning seeing. So we can interpret this to mean that we go beyond seeing conventional reality and achieve the extra seeing of the universal reality. As Lama often would say that, of Mahamudra, of emptiness. In other words, we need the two kinds of meditation together, calm abiding and special insight. The benefits of samadhi are incredible. Nevertheless, even without special insight, the results of samadhi alone are unbelievable, almost unimaginable. So when we understand this, when we realize how amazing the results are, we cannot help but to try to develop it. There is no way we become lazy. We will have much energy and make great effort. We won't even worry about eating. I will explain some of the benefits. You go beyond sensory and conceptual consciousness. I mean, right there, that's mystical to us. We don't posit that level of cognition in modern psychology, at least not yet. With these marvelous discussions with His Holiness, people are open up to these things now, you know. As your concentration develops, you will go beyond your body. Your mind will be non-conceptual. Again, this is pretty abstract for us. You know, when you study the epistemological model of the mind, you'll learn that the mind functions at a conceptual level, which is the way we function day to day, which is the gross level of mental consciousness. And then we have perception. This is a term they use very specifically in Buddhist psychology. It's a very broad term. We can use it any way we like in our culture. But in Buddhist psychology, it's referring to necessarily a non-conceptual level of cognition. So in terms of the mental consciousness, we virtually never touch that. And we only get that when we get single point of concentration. That's when we begin to touch this subtler level of cognition that is not conceptual. We don't comprehend that, I think, because we don't have this approach to the mind in neuroscience. Your mind will be non-conceptual, so it'll become easy. It's easy to cut the complex world of the five sense objects, to eliminate the superstitions, the afflictions. In such a unified state, your mind becomes so subtle, so sharp, you can easily eradicate the complex dualistic thoughts. You can touch reality. This is the feature of samadhi. And out of meditation, you can easily deal with your delusions. They are so light, you can stop them immediately. That is where, when we can have great courage to know that's our potential. Right now, we are just dragged, aren't we, by all our crazy emotions. Completely dragged by them. It seems an utter impossibility. Even if our thoughts aren't even very violent, even if it's sort of normal thoughts, we know they're completely uncontrolled. And it seems like an utter joke to think that you can control them. We know this. Look when you're trying to get asleep at night. You think you've gone mad. But your mind's doing that all the time. It's just that during the day, we're so busy with the external world, if it's no drama in here, we just don't notice. But it's 1,000 thoughts a second raging on, uncontrolled, has been for eons. To think that we can have effortless control over every thought is like science fiction for our psychology. This is what these Indians more than 3,000 years ago discovered. I mean, we ought to be impressed, you know. Only now maybe some scientists are starting to be impressed, and that's because of His Holiness bringing it into the world. It's unbelievable. You experience bliss. In the subtle state of concentration, you experience bliss, ecstatic bliss, just naturally. Again, there is nothing like this in our culture because we talk about the brain. We're not discussing anything not physical, are we? The more concentration you have, the more integrated you are, and thus the more rapture, the more bliss you experience. And the interesting point about this, anybody who's even, and this is certainly what Venerable Renee said, anybody who's had any kind of meditation experience, even briefly, the key point is that bliss is utterly and completely calm. Look at any pleasure we have in ordinary life through our senses. Even a delicious cake, your mind's agitated like crazy, isn't it? Forget sexual pleasure. You go berserk. People go berserk. So, because it's based on attachment. And attachment makes us berserk. So we can't imagine bliss that's peaceful. We just can't imagine it. It's like our bliss is like hyperventilating. Our even slight pleasure. This is completely unknown to us. The more bliss, the more clarity, the more clarity, the more calm, steady, unberserk. And this is natural. It's not like a gift from God or anything. Weird. I'm not being rude. I mean, I sound rude, I know that. In the beginning, the bliss you experience is physical, which is the grossest level. But as your concentration deepens, as you throw off the layers of blankets of grosser consciousness, you experience bliss exclusively at the mental level. This is because you've stopped perceiving the objects of the five senses. And you've closed the door to superstition, the conceptuality. All the contradictory concepts have disappeared. Your mind is now crystal clear. As if you could count every atom. As your concentration gets stronger and you reach ever subtler levels, your mind becomes super powerful. From his own experience, Lama Tsongkhapa says that you can reach a point of such clarity in your meditation that your mind feels almost infinite. Your mind is so clear, so sharp, it's as if you can distinguish all the subtle physical energies. You'll have the courageous thought, I can count all the atoms of the universe. This level of mind is more powerful than even scientific instruments. Now I think I'm showing pride in Buddhism. You will have an experience... No, forget that one. Don't worry. This must be an older version. What have I done? You'll always be joyful. Can you find that there? Always be joyful. When you arise from your meditation, you feel liberated instead of uncertain and full of doubts and conflicts. You experience inner peace. You will always have a happy, joyful vibration. In fact, you continuously experience tremendous pleasure. Now the pleasure of chocolate is nothing to you. And this is, before we go, this is a simple meaning of what attachment is. Attachment is this hunger. It's an emotional hunger. And why are you hungry? It's because you feel like you're lacking something. It's so obvious. That's dissatisfaction. The deeper energetic level from the practice of attachment. No matter what happens, we're always dissatisfied. Always thinking something will be better. Always thinking in the future, what maybe this and maybe that'll do. We're never satisfied. As Lama Zopa says, this is the worst disease of Westerners. It's tragic, you know. And we believe it. We never question it. So when you're satisfied, when your mind is blissful, if you've attained samadhi and you live in your daily life and you practice every day, you are blissful. You, therefore, are infinitely satisfied. I'll read you also. Have you ever read that letter, Ciliana, from Pemo? Do you ever see that letter that Pemo wrote to Rinpoche about her meditation experiences?
Many years ago.
Yeah. It's unbelievable. We'll read it. And that's well, this friend of ours who's considered, like, really neurotic. She's famous for being like this bag lady. When she goes to meditation retreats, she almost has a bag big enough for another cushion, and she's always with her bag, day and night. And you'd think she's this bag lady. She looks like a homeless bag lady. And then she's this meditator. She's a great yogini. She's a great yogini, but you'd never know it by looking. If you think Kundala is the only kind of yogini, then I'm sorry, you'd be disappointed. You met Kundala here, have you? I mean, everyone falls in love with her because she's so cute. But this Pemo, she's unbelievable. I mean, she's my friend. But she acts like a neurotic, complaining, moaning, unhappy person. But she's this incredible yogini. So this experience she described in her meditation retreat, and this is one of the points, I'll read you maybe her letter, it's very inspiring, was just, she didn't want anything. It's utterly joyful. When you're satisfied, you don't want anything. That means there's no, because attachment, you don't need attachment. Attachment's not always hungry for something. You're satisfied. And this is the thing we have to practice. As Lama Yeshe says, we've got to practice being satisfied. So how do you do that? Well, dissatisfaction always thinks I should be doing something else, or maybe I should do this, or why not have this, or perhaps I should do this instead. And it's an agitated, unhappy state of mind. So, of course, it doesn't mean you can't change things. Be practical sometimes. But when it's a deep disease, which it is for most of us, then the way to counteract that is what do we say in the quest? It's so lovely. You count your blessings. It's a very profound statement. That woman in prison, who you'd think wouldn't have many blessings, husband executed, accused of murder, children gone, parents dead, living in this nightmare, treated like an animal, she counted her blessings, another way of saying it. So guess what? She would have been happy. This is the point. It's so simple. But it's hard for us to count our blessings. It's hard. So we just have to do that. Remember all the good things. How fortunate we are. We've got enough money in the bank. We've got to live. We're doing this. We've got that. Our body's healthy. We've got this. We've got friends. I mean, all the things we have got. We'd be like 0.1% of the universe. Not 0.1% rich. 0.1. This is the perfect human rebirth discussion. But we never remember that. We just believe I haven't got enough. I should be doing something else. I should have something else. It's a deep disease. It's a real disease. It's a mental illness. And the tragedy is we always believe it. And that's what increases attachment, because it's a function of attachment, to be dissatisfied. And then we believe, when I get the other thing, somehow that'll bring the satisfaction. We know this. We're familiar with it. The pleasure of chocolate now is nothing to you. What you can now experience with your mind is super. It's like another realm, another dimension. And when your senses do come into contact with their objects, of course, you experience bliss then too. Extra bliss, kind of bonus bliss. You hardly even notice whether it's night or day. Actually, even now, when you have samsaric happiness, you have a similar experience. You dance and drink all night, intoxicated with the pleasure. Time just flies. Oh, now it's morning. Wow. Already. So, well, this is what happens when you're intoxicated with the blissful experience of samadhi. And, of course, never mind that. But this is the point, you know. This is what Buddha's saying. It's not a wholly special thing that you're allowed to have, which is a blessing from some person. It is just the natural state of your own mind. That's what's so empowering. Your body feels so light. They call it physical pliancy. You have this particular mental and physical pliancy. They talk about how, like, you have effort, like Lama's saying, effortless control over every thought, and your body feels like air. Feels like you don't have a body. When you're out of meditation, the heavy energy of your body vanishes. Your body feels like a brand new body. You feel so light, almost as if you could fly, almost as if you have no body at all. They call it physical pliancy. Special kind of quality. You develop clairvoyance. Next page. Lama Tsongkhapa says that you will develop clairvoyance. According to the Abhidharma teachings, there are two kinds. One is what we understand as intuition, an untrained sense that we all have to some extent. For example, you might feel strongly, without any logical proof, that something has happened to your dear friend back home. The other can be gained by training the mind in meditation, as we're discussing here. You are able to see long distances, as well as other people, including their minds. At first, your experience seems a bit like a dream, but the more your concentration develops, the more clearly you can see, just as you would if you were there in person. This kind of clairvoyance is not imagining something. It's real, in the present, not a fantasy. So that's the simple point that Buddha's making. The Hindus have discovered this, genius Indians, that when we have access, that this subtler, in general, this subtler level of our mind, being more subtle, can cognize phenomena that are more subtle, that cannot be cognized by the senses and by conceptuality. We live at the very tip of a very gross level of our mind. Our concepts are very brilliant. But, you know, we don't remember most things, do we? We talk about not remembering a past life. That's a joke. It's 12:30. Even an hour after you got up today, you wouldn't have been able to remember 99% of your thoughts and of exactly what you did every second, because conceptuality is not capable. But the subtle mind is. And this kind of clairvoyance, as you progress spiritually, is not just like, as we think of it in the West, these people who are clairvoyant, who have kind of flashes, you know, kind of momentary, I see this and I see a vision. This is just really vague, gross clairvoyance and not necessarily accurate. This is the natural level of our mind, and the more you develop your spiritual practice, the more you get rid of the delusions, the more you realize, the more powerful your clairvoyance. That's exactly, you know, and as Buddha says, we can't really do much to help sentient beings until we've got that, you know. This is psychology. This is the Buddhist view of the mind. You know, the secret part of us that does this. It's not mystical. It's methodology, and it's still living methodology. It's still living. These techniques are all there in the literature, is living knowledge. This is what's incredible, you know. It's not myth. It's not cross your fingers and hope for the best. Time for lunch. Okay, so we think how marvelous, get excited, we've got this potential, maybe use this somehow, maybe develop clairvoyance, maybe develop concentration, so we can develop our, so we can get insight, so we can get realization, so we can be of benefit to other sentient beings. That's the long-term goal, the long-term aim. All these seeds we've planted since this morning, may we nourish them with our efforts. So they do develop, and exactly as we've talked, for our sake and the sake of others. So we think of lunch now. We haven't talked about emptiness yet. We'll just touch on it with lunch. Basically, one way of talking about emptiness is Lama Zopa never stops talking about it at the highest level. Everything's merely labelled. Everything is projected by the mind. So let's think of lunch like that. We think lunch is in the lunch. No, lunch comes from the mind. As Lama Zopa says, from the side of lunch there is not one atom of lunchness. Okay? It's all made by the mind. But it still is lunch, and it still functions as lunch, and it nourishes you. That's the two truths together. So you don't fly off into the abyss of the great mistake, as Tsongkhapa says. So we just think of it as this delicious stuff. We just do a little meditation. Imagine it just disappearing into space, all lunch. Now it manifests as a big container in the sky, and we bless it with the energy of all the holy beings, body, speech, and mind. Om Ma Hung, Om Ma Hung, Om Ma Hung. So we have this vast nectar, transcendental, blissful nectar, in the nature of bliss. And now we offer it. We think of all the gurus, all the buddhas, all the bodhisattvas, all the suffering sentient beings pervading space. And then we think of all of them experiencing the bliss of receiving this delicious nectar, that if we could offer it, we would to every one of them. Lama Sangye, Lama Che, Dejen Lama Gedun Te, Kungi Jepo Lama Te, Lama Namla, Che Pa Bun. So did you do any discussion yesterday? Did it work? Did you do it? Did you do some discussion? Was it useful? Some of you? One of you? Two of you? Four of you? Good. Do it again. So... okay, so what are we talking about today? So remember, whatever you talked about, try and take one or more of these points. Take the point about the difference between, one point would be the difference between the delusions and the virtues, attachment and love. We did this a little bit. The difference between low self-esteem and confidence, or what pride is, just these few delusions. Or talk about, but keep one thing and go into it. Or talk about this business of how karma and feeling and attachment all work together, It's very intricate and very kind of humbling to understand this technology and how we get sucked into believing things. And that the stronger our pleasant feelings, the more strong the habit to do that action. And therefore the more attachment that comes along and writes a novel about it and makes it divine. This is the killer. This is what keeps us paralyzed in samsara. So just take some of these points and don't ask questions about things you read last week. This is like cooking class. You discuss only the recipes we've discussed this morning. Think of it like that. And then bring your questions. And I thank you very much. So, yeah, that's it. Okay, goodbye. I'm going to stay here for a second. Let's just talk about... yeah. I'm going to stay here now. Talk to you. Thank you.